With me at the moment is Warren Edge, the Chief Opposition Whip in the House of Representatives. How are you this morning?
I'm very well indeed.
Okay then. As the Chief Opposition Whip in the House, you've obviously got to organise the numbers in the House so the bill can either be passed or defeated. Can you describe what steps goes into that particular process in relation to a bill that is currently being placed within the House?
Well, it's just a matter of giving all of our side of politics in the coalition opportunity to speak, those that want to speak on the bill, to make sure that they turn up in time so that they to be able to do that, because it's important that that they are available to speak. And you know, we're a very busy place and sometimes people get distracted, so my office always reminds them and follows up to make sure that they're there at the allotted time. And then once the debate has been completed, and if it requires a vote, it's then to make sure I will beep all of the coalition members and encourage them to get to the chamber and to make sure that that everybody's there to participate. I mean, particularly in a hung parliament where the numbers are just so tight, if it's a piece of very contentious legislation, I don't believe that any of our members would like to be the one that missed the vote that may have either put something through or rejected it, because they would be very quickly identified, and it would probably cause them some serious... First of all, they would be incredibly embarrassed by it, but it could, depending on the legislation, it could cause them a huge amount of problems within their own electorates if they're not, because they're down here. There's an expectation from within the voting public that if you're down here, you are going to participate in debates and you are going to participate in votes. And if you don't turn up for a particular for a critical vote, it causes something to be either won or lost, which is against maybe what your constituents are looking to happen. It can cause you some grief.
Okay then. What happens when, as Chief Whip, you decide to vote against your own party? Who organises a coalition in such a circumstance?
I've never seen that scenario. I'm not aware of any. You know, as a member of the executive, I'm expected to argue my position in the party room or within the executive. If I have had a particularly strong view against something. But I've never been in a situation in this role where I have had any disagreements or strong disagreements in relation to a particular piece of legislation. Quite the contrary.
Okay then. In 2004, you first voiced your support for marriage equality and other LGBTI rights. Could you describe what made you decide to support those particular rights?
Yeah, we were debating in the party room the reaffirmation of the Marriage Act. And I asked the question of the then Prime Minister as to why we were doing it. And I was assured that there was nothing to be concerned about, nothing was going to change. And so my question was, well, if nothing's going to change, why do we do it? All you're doing is you're bringing a focus onto one group within our community and who are already being quite severely ostracised, if you like, or in some cases vilified and certainly discriminated against. And if bringing legislation through is just going to put the spotlight on those relationships and really do nothing at all, I said I had serious reservations about it and I was not comfortable in participating in that debate. At that point, it surprised a lot of people because I guess as I was stereotyped in the media afterwards, you know, how was I described? Fiercely heterosexual, crocodile catching, bull catching, far north Queensland, and heaven forbid a liberal. Standing up for gay rights. and Glenn Milne did a couple of articles at the time. I didn't realise the significance of him pigeonholing me and with that until I started to receive a lot of correspondence from family and friends of gays who said congratulations for making a stand. If somebody of your background is prepared to stand up for the rights of the gay community, then we want to stand. We want to come out and support you as well. And that was the start of it. Now, at that point in time, I had very little understanding of all of the different issues that were and challenges that were facing the community, but the gay community. But I was contacted then by Rodney Croom from Tasmania and David Scammell from New South Wales. They were two key ones. And they came here to my office and we sat down and they went through a whole range of issues which I was just absolutely shocked. From then, of course, I started getting a lot of correspondence from people in gay relationships and gay men and lesbian women. And I started to get a much better understanding where the problems was, and through that I started to develop my arguments. And initially it was a bit of a challenge, I've got to tell you, because nobody really wanted to talk to me about it. I have a way of raising these issues, and I've done it successfully in mental health and other areas, and I do that by every time there's an opportunity, every party room meeting, I always stand up and I will give graphic examples and I will talk about it. And initially, people were ducking and weaving. They didn't want to be confronted by it. They were uncomfortable. But eventually people started to listen to what I was saying. And interestingly enough, the first person... And I started inviting, gender-diverse people here to the Parliament and introducing them to my colleagues. And interestingly enough, the first person to speak in the party room to support me was Barnaby Joyce. And I'll always appreciate that from Barnaby. But I eventually started to... You could see that I was starting to build momentum, and that momentum... I was had just as much difficulty on the other side too, because they didn't... The Labor Party didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want a bar of it. But eventually we started again, and I introduced the Prime Minister to a couple of different individuals in different circumstances, and a couple that I highlighted was a retired public servant in his late 70s, had been in a relationship with a same-sex partner for over 50 years, and there were superannuation issues relating to that because the younger person had no super. And if the other one had died, the superannuation would have transferred to his partner, life partner of 50 years. I had another one which was a ex-SAS soldier who had served, from memory, in Timor, Solomon's, Iraq and Afghanistan, where he was hurt and came out. And he was in a hell of a state because his partner of 15 years, and that's before he went into the army, would not have got the entitlements that they should have as a partner if anything happened to him. And I think that was the one that really drove home to people like the Prime Minister when I explained that this partner, of course, was same-sex. And I remember the reaction was, "You're kidding, he's SAS." And I took great delight in explaining to the Prime Minister that a person's courage is not determined by their sexuality. And if you go through history, some of our greatest warriors, of course, were gay or lesbian. So, and that, I think, was a turning moment. And so that's how I got it successful. But that's how I... And I've always made a point, you know, even though Glenn Milne took it upon himself to describe me as being a... fiercely heterosexual individual, whenever asked, and of course I'm often asked in interviews whether or not I'm gay, because of my strong public advocacy, and my standard response is I'm whatever the interviewer feels comfortable in me being, because I don't have an issue with it, and quite frankly, it's irrelevant. And so if the interviewer feels that he's more comfortable, or they're more comfortable in talking to me as a gay man, then I'm happy to be gay. And vice versa, whatever they feel, because I refuse. I don't think it is necessary to declare your sexuality, and I make a deliberate point of doing that. But I will continue to advocate very, very strongly. I think the 2008, even though I left in 2007, I was comfortable because I knew that both sides had already agreed to all of the changes in relation to superannuation and a whole range of other things, and I'm very, very proud of that. When I had that break to spend some time with my son, when I came back, the first meeting I had in this office on arriving back in Parliament was with Rodney Grimm, who was then now heading the Marriage Equality Coalition.
That's correct.
And Rodney told me about his campaign, and I explained to him and it was great to see him again, it had been some time, but I explained to him that I couldn't support that. And that the reason that I couldn't support it was that over the years, as I've built up my advocacy, the people that I needed to change their opinion, I had to convince them that by supporting what I was trying to do, I was not to be seen as a Trojan horse for gay marriage, because even though they supported me in a whole range of things, they had real issues with that. And so I'd made that commitment that what I was doing, I would never engage marriage, because it seems to be a diversion, and as soon as you mention it, everything else gets forgotten. And I think that if we'd have talked marriage at the beginning of my journey of advocacy, we would never have got past that.
Okay, then. Over the past few weeks, the Australian Christian lobby has been extremely vocal about the opposition to same-sex and gender diverse rights, with Jim Wallace comparing gay people to smoking. If you could do one thing that would change Mr. Wallace's mind about marriage equality and other minority rights, what would it be?
Well, can I say to you in the first instance, I think the issue that he's raising here is more about marriage equality. I don't think, from what I could see, it's all about marriage equality, and it's about the current debate that's going to be happening in this Parliament here, happening here very shortly. In fact, I've contributed earlier this week, I think, to it. His opinion, I find quite frankly offensive. I mean, any suggestion that homosexuality somehow or other is a lifestyle choice is just an absolute nonsense. And I think in the first instance, what I would like to do is I'll take him to visit his local cemetery, and we'll do a roll call on the number of people that are laying in that cemetery that have been forced to take their lives because they have never been able to come to terms with their sexuality, and in some cases they have been bullied and they have been ostracised and vilified and to be made to feel as something of a less of a person by opinions that were expressed by Jim Wallace. That'd be the first thing I'd do. The second thing I'd do is I'd take them to some families of gay that have got gay children, who've had their gay children, and let him ascertain for himself as to whether or not that is a lifestyle choice, or whether, you know, and some of the challenges that the families have had in trying to come to terms with the sexuality of their children. And that P flag would be a great place to start. We'll introduce them to some of the families there that have actually come to terms with it and have actually embraced their children, because, you know, those kids, irrespective of the diversity of their gender, they still bleed when you scratch them. They've got a heart there that beats, and, you know, they still emotionally get very upset. Many of them are quite fragile in many ways because of the way they've been treated. And to suggest that the suffering and in many cases a lot of the trauma and the issues that they've had to face has been self-inflicted because they've chose to be of a particular gender diversity is just quite bizarre. And so that's where I think that I would go. And then I could introduce him to some individuals that have been in very long-term gay relationships, very, very long. I mean, one comes to mind immediately is John Challis and his partner Arthur, who've been together now for probably closer to 60 years than 50 years. And see if they stereotype the suggestion of short lives, you know, and all the other nonsense that comes out of this. And so I think that's the sort of things. I don't know whether it is the Australian Christian lobby per se, or whether it is him and a small rump within that organisation, but I'm surprised, given his education, his background, his experience, I would have thought that he would be a little bit more informed in these matters. And but he certainly needs to have a little bit more exposure. And it surprised me too, because during my advocacy, I've got letters from pretty much every faith, from Muslims to all different Christian denominations, from Jewish, from a whole lot, from leaders within ordained ministers, senior ordained ministers, and senior clerics, all supporting what I'm doing. In fact, the overwhelming majority of them support what I'm doing and are prepared to be public and write to me. And so I just don't think that you could say it's a general view of anybody associated with the Christian, because, you know, I see myself as non-denominational but still of Christian faith. That's what I grew up with. And to sit back and hear him make those sort of comments, I just find it abhorrent.
Okay, then. Over the last couple of weeks, there's also been debate about bullying online due to a number of trolling incidents that have happened, specifically in regards to Charlotte Dawson's attempt to take her own life, and also the bullying has resulted towards the Prime Minister as a result of the death of her father. Do you think there need to be stricter any bullying measures taken?
I have a... It's interesting you ask that question. I've been working on an adjournment speech for some time now, but being careful to get my facts. It's not just Twitter and Facebook. There are anonymous blogs out there with some of the most disgusting, vile individuals running them that say some things that can never be repeated. And I've been doing some research on one that's based in Cairns, and this individual takes great delight in placing things on his blog, like accusing a local member of parliament of being a misogynist prick and a rapist supporter. Another public figure's wife of being in a lesbian relationship. I won't bore you with some of the stuff that he's said about myself. But he a lot of it's of a sexual, disgusting, perverted sexual nature. And the blog site is anonymous. He projects it's been registered in the United States. He projects a image that it is actually run by is by a local talkback host in Cairns, when in actual fact the whole thing's set to ostracise and attack this talkback radio host and anybody that actually comes onto his program that in any way is seen to be positively engaging. So they are open game. Now, I've done a lot of research on this individual, and I know who he is, I know where he lives, I know what his businesses are, and I know his background, and I intend to, in fact, I've finished the speech now, I'm just waiting for a speaking opportunity, and I will be using some of these other examples. That, is it Farah, the footballer?
Robbie Farah.
Yeah, Robbie Farah, and that other incident that you raised, and a couple of others that I'm aware of, as a lead-in, because it's not just Twitter and Facebook. I think that these anonymous bloggers need to be exposed, and it's my intention to expose this individual right down to where he lives, his home address, so that people know exactly who it is, because people like this need to be seen for what they are, and they should be condemned, and there needs to be legislation put in place that can lock these crazy imbeciles up.
Okay. Warren Lynch, thank you very much.
Well, look, first, thank you, but can I just say to you that now that I'm in my next part, as you know, I actually established when the first thing I did when I came back here after telling Rodney that I wasn't going to support his marriage equity coalition, and I won't, but I explained to him the reason I wasn't going to do it, because I realised in that 2.5 years I had off that there was unfinished business. One of the areas we hadn't touched was aged care, and so we're now, and so as a basis of trying to finish this, I established the Parliament, first ever National Parliamentary Friendship Group for the LGBTI, lesbians, gays, bisexual, transsexual, intersexual community. We've had our first function. I've got Graham Perrott as my deputy and Sarah Hanson-Young. It's an interesting combination.
Very nice.
An old far north Queensland bull-catching liberal with a left-wing Labor Party person and, of course, a Green from... So it's an interesting combination. But having said that, we try to be tri-party because there are a lot of things we need to do. But I've got Graham Perrott focusing on the aged care stuff. And I'm focusing now purely on transsexual and intersexual issues, because that's an area that hasn't been touched, and they're the reasons why I'm not going to get involved in the marriage debate.
It's actually interesting that you mention that particular issue, because over the past about 7 or 8 years, I've actually been dealing with a lot of those different issues myself. And one of the things I've noticed is that, like... in rural areas especially, there's not really much in the way of support for people from the gender diverse community. What do you think can be done in order to improve the services and level of support for people in that particular community?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I actually became aware of gender diverse issues much earlier in my life. Actually, at a time when I was riding that horse at the... I was there, that's probably out near Croydon, and I was actually going with a young girl who was a barmaid at Normanton Hotel. And we used to go to Georgetown every weekend for weekends, and she had a cousin there who, for some reason, didn't buy many beers when we went out. He always was with us. He didn't buy too many beers. And I found myself buying beer for him, and whenever you get a few more beer, this person got in, and more feminine he became, and used to end up in having to defend him at different times, people that didn't know him. And I often said to him, for goodness sake, it's bad enough you don't buy a beer, but if I'm going to buy a beer, for goodness sake, don't be such a sheila, because in doing that, I'm always spending more time having a blue, trying to protect you, than I am having a drink, and I've only got the weekend. It was quite funny. But anyway, before Christmas one year, he disappeared, and it was some months later, I was sitting at the Normanton Hotel with my then-girlfriend's mother and father, who were running the pub, and I see this young lass come flitting through in short shorts and a boob tube, and I said, oh, who the hell's that? And they told me that was the guy. And the reason he hadn't been spending his money, he'd been saving his money and going down to Sydney, and had a gender change. Now, it was amazing. It was, suddenly it hit me. But I wish I had the letter, the email, and it was this incident that Milne wrote about, and in an article about 2004 or 2005. And I'd never ever seen that person again he had a nickname, Posty, at the time, but never seen him from when I left up there in the late 70s. But I always remembered it, and reflecting with Glenn Milne. And he wrote this article, and it was a really good full-page article. And a few days later, I got this email that caused me to really tear up. And it started off by saying, "Dear Warren, thank you for sharing your/our story." And She went on then to say to me, you know, hadn't been people like you back in those days, you know, that were there to, prepared to defend me, that, you know, I'd never been able to achieve what I had. She also made a comment that she never ever felt discrimination until she went to the cities. Now, what happened? She went on and she got a year 12, went to university, and at the time of writing in 2004, she'd just graduated as a medical doctor working in a hospital in Melbourne. And she said that her commitment was to rural Australia, and she was doing a rural doctor's course, and she was going to be going in to be a doctor in rural areas. I saw her for the first time since 1979, about 4 weeks ago. I was asked to speak at a transgender sister girl and gender diverse conference in Cairns. And this quite attractive blonde come out of the group and come up and give me a big kiss. And I thought, wow, hello, how are you? Then I stepped back and I looked, and she says, do you remember me? She's gorgeous, and she's working in a Far North Queensland hospital now as a doctor. And I'm hoping that I can get her to come down here for the next meeting of the parliamentary friendship group. She's the one that really started me on the journey. She's the first one that I, you know, the first person that I knew that had gone through those challenges. And she's just a delightful person, you know. She's a lovely person, and she's a medical doctor. Can you imagine how difficult it would have been for her? And I would have thought, you asked the question about in rural Australia. She said that's where she felt the most comfortable. Services weren't there because she needed to get to, she had to go into Sydney to get her reassignment done, but nevertheless, she still managed. I'm not too sure exactly what else is required, and because it's still a very steep learning curve for me, but I have a good friend in Peter Hendel, who is the chair of the A Agenda organisation that is basically focusing on issues of transgender and the intersex community. He had a conference. He organised a conference a little while ago, and he's now. I've asked him to give me a list of issues, and to prioritise them in areas of importance. That will be hopefully ready in the next couple of weeks, he tells me, and we're intending to launch it at the function that we're doing in October. I will then be able to give you some answers as to what needs to be done, and hopefully in specific areas if that's being addressed. But I can tell you now the experiences that I've had with Alana, and knowing her both as a young man and as a woman, has really cemented my views in relation to this area. And she's really, you know, she's contributed a lot to my understanding, and I'm very, very proud of what she's achieved, and any way I can make her life a little bit easier, I'll do anything I can to do that. And that's a fact.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.